This is a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. You're listening to Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
It's all about living your best life
on Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to the Afternoons with me, Helen Farmer podcast. Hope you're having a fantastic time listening back to some of our best bits. This is the real life stories, the experts, and giving you the answers that you need. We're talking health on Sundays. How has COVID-19 impacted our children's milestones, their development, and even their potty training? In conversation with Lisa Sarrington-Boyd, aka the Potty Queen, to talk about some of the things that people do wrong when it comes to potty training and taking your questions too. And we have seen some very disturbing trends when it comes to teens with their body image, with dieting, with addictions to exercise. We were speaking to Florence Julet of Beyond Body Image about some of the ways we can protect our children and move forward in health.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Asking this afternoon, how has COVID-19 impacted children's life skills? Principal Lisa joining us on the line, aka the Potty Queen, as we talk development and key skills that your child might have missed out on or even lost this year. So an education watchdog in the UK has found that some children have actually regressed due to COVID-19 related school closures, restrictions and social side too. And report from Ofsted, that's the Office of Standards and Education, Children's Services and Skills, said that some kids have fallen back in basic skills and some who were really greatly impacted have even forgotten things like how to use a knife and fork. So Ofsted made visits to 900 schools and early childcare providers in September and October, according to a press release from the UK government. And it found that there were three broad groups of children, according to the Chief Inspector, Amanda Spielberg. So one is the hardest hit group of kids. This group has suffered from time out from school, has gone backwards on words and numbers. They've also reverted to wearing nappies or being potty trained and have lost those basic skills, such as using a knife and fork. Delighted to have Lisa Sherrington-Boyd live with us this afternoon. How are you, Lisa?
Oh, I'm fantastic. Hi, Helen.
Thank you so much for joining us. I love picking your brains and getting your take on it because I know how plugged in you are to the parent community here in the UAE. And that's really distressing news, to be honest. You know, we've talked a lot about, you know, social impacts of COVID-19, of lockdown, but these actual really basic life skills and failing to hit some of those key milestones is something that hadn't really occurred to me. And I wondered if it's something, this report's from the UK, but have you seen anything similar or parents coming forward with similar concerns?
I am. And I think that we knew that COVID was going to impact everybody. We knew that it was going to impact children. And we still don't have a full picture of how this situation is going to impact children long term. However, what we do know is that things shifted and changed early on in this year, and that impacted everything. And families have been under a great deal of stress and strain. So I regularly get phone calls from very worried mums and dads, particularly September, while my feet barely touched the ground, with really worried parents in September, mm-hmm. because their child would have spent perhaps the summer in a summer camp. Their child would have spent, you know, several months in nursery in the lead up to going to school. But what they found was is that, particularly, you know, in the 3 years age group, that they had to go back to school and that development phase had been skipped. Therefore, that had impacted toileting, you know, language development, mm-hmm. social skills. And so there are lots of worried parents at the moment. And I do try to reassure them and say that I don't believe that skills have been lost. I don't think skills have been forgotten. I don't even really like the word regression. I feel that skills have shifted and we've got to get back to doing what things we were doing before that were working, because routines, those rituals, those common practices, the things we were doing before have shifted. And I think if we can bring those back in, little children's skills will just start to, you know, come back again. They've not forgotten. There's muscle memory in there, Helen.
I think your point about kind of everyone being out of routine and out of sync in some ways is a really interesting one, because I know an awful lot of families who've had a really, really difficult year, and that could be their priorities or their attention just might not be where they would have been had it not been for the pandemic. And that could be through financial stresses, job losses, intense homeschooling, and why they might have planned to do potty training or be thinking about, you know, extracurricular, blah, 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 that they haven't really had the headspace to do that. And it's been very much an attitude of, we'll worry about that later. We'll worry that's a problem for future us. We'll get to that. And as a result, things have, as you say, milestones have slipped. These kind of developments have slipped. Now, I know this sounds strange, but why do you think skills such as eating with a knife and fork have been impacted?
Well, there's an interesting thing here, is that some families have reported that actually their family meal times have improved because mum and dad have been maybe working at home. So there are some families that say, oh, he's eating better than, eating better than ever. But so in my job as the potty queen, I work with families on a variety of issues, not just potty, sometimes potty eating, sometimes sleeping. So a few little things have started to creep in for some families that might have impacted the use of knives and forks. The big one is iPads, Helen. You see, because we were in those difficult times of where the children were stuck indoors, iPads came in and we were using them, quite rightly so, to get through that difficult period.
Exactly. However, surviving, not thriving. But there absolutely is an impact on even like the style of food that you might serve to a child if they're watching an iPad. And this is me. My kids will go, can I have a snack plate? And they'll ultimately kind of have the similar stuff that they might have as a knife and fork sitting at the table. But it's things that they would pick up with their fingers while they're watching. Does that sound relatable?
Yes. Yes, and the other thing is, I'm talking to families as well, there's also that anxiety, are they eating enough? Have they got enough nutrition? Mm-hmm. You see, parenting anxiety has gone up. And so that spoon is coming across the shoulder, the one that, and that goes in and feeds the child for them. The parenting anxiety spoon. Quick, just eat a little bit, And so there's routines that have changed, parents are working, long hours, so is everybody. But, it's difficult if you're a parent, the demands have gone up, you're frightened of maybe losing your job. So you're not necessarily going to have that mind space, like you say, to think, well, tonight I'm going to cook shepherd's pie and we'll all sit down and it'll all be la-di-da and we'll all have a knife and fork. There's been an element of survival here.
100%.
But those skills haven't been lost. They just need to be tweaked back out and encouraged and routines put back in place.
So, Lisa, going to the text line, and as I said, people can be anonymous if they prefer, and I'm not surprised that this one has left their name off, saying, over Christmas, my sister's family and her two children, daughters age 9 and 7, are coming to stay. Last time, every meal was a war zone. They wouldn't use cutlery. Everything was picked up and eaten with fingers after it had been sniffed. If they didn't like something, they'd pretend to be sick and make gagging noises. Actually, sitting didn't happen. Kneeling, standing, fidgeting with the main activities. I could go on. Advice needed so my kids don't pick up these habits in a few weeks' time. Oh, this sounds like... it sounds pretty stressful, to be honest. It really does in many, many ways. But how to navigate that when it comes to...
Well, I'm not sure how old the children are.
Nine and seven.
Oh, 9 and 7. Right. Okay. So we've got 9 and 7-year-olds who I'm assuming have got some established mealtime routines that mum likes and mum values. Mm-hmm. And then family arrive and those routines and behaviours kind of go out of the window, it seems. So the first word that kind of comes into my mind when I'm working with a family in a situation like this is expectations. So to avoid disappointment, to have an expectation for yourself of, well, what is the minimum that you would expect from your children in that situation? Is that a realistic expectation? Is it realistic to expect your children to follow their normal routine if their cousins are stepping into the situation and they don't need to sit at the table? It's really, really difficult. And I would probably be preempting that with my family and saying, look, I've worked really hard on practicing these routines. are there some of these that you would also value and that you would also like to practice, you know, this holiday season? I do something called a five-stage process with families. So, for example, I get five paper plates, a big piece of string, and I line up five plates and I would hang them up wherever the challenge was. So let's say this was meal times, and I would decide with my group of children or with my family what things are going to be important to us in that situation. So if we say, well, the rule is we always just stay at the table, so then that gets written up on paper plate one that's hanging there. If the second rule is that we don't have our iPads at the table, we all agree on that, and then we put that up there. So everybody in the team has agreed on an approach to meal times or whatever the situation is, and it's there visual, as a visual. And children are very good at this. They hold us accountable. They say, it says on plate number two.
I could see mine being proper goody two-shoes, massive hypocrites about stuff like this. But there is something quite pleasing to children about having that, you know, those guidelines, you know, being laid out. And I think often children need those boundaries and that kind of clarity.
Well, that's it. You see, my five-stage process works in any situation, and I just think that if you get their buy-in, so get your guests buy-in, get the children's buy-in, and then everybody agrees on it, they're more likely to want to stick to it. And there's also an element of excitement here, isn't there? You know, new people coming over, you know, family coming to stay. It's exciting for children, and they, you know, they don't mean to really, but they sort of get lost in the moment, don't they?
Yeah, that's right. And maybe this could help our next message. AJ saying, we live with my wife's parents and they really baby our son. He's 7. Even feeding him if he asks /whinges. Yes, I know that very well. Can definitely see him going backwards this year as he's spending more time at home. We haven't returned him to school this term. Any tips for politely telling my in-laws that they're not helping, even though they think they are? Oh, the in-laws chat. Yeah. I don't envy you there, AJ. But I think... I think it's a generation thing, and also they're coming from a really caring place of wanting to look after him, and you know, but as you seem to be concerned that you've seen him going backwards. So Lisa, what would you advise here?
Well, some of what I've just said is
definitely
his family, but I deal with this issue actually quite a lot, and that loving, nurturing side of family members wants to, you know, do their best for this little 7-year-old, but it's about thanking them for that, you know, saying how much you appreciate that love, but that you're discovering more and more that your son doesn't always have the skills that he needs to compete with his peers, or that he's a VIP of the future, or he's, you know, he's got such a great future, but he's going to need to be able to eat for himself. This is a fundamental skill. So, you know, I'm going to ask you, just while you're here, not to do that, because we've worked really hard on it. So when I'm working with a family, they will use me as an excuse. So
I love it. You're the scapegoat. Let's blame nasty Lisa. But I think that, actually think that can be really useful, because then it's a case of, well, you know, we have asked the experts, and this is what we're going to try as a family. And as you say, to increase his independence, to make sure he is keeping up with his peers. I like that. Blame someone else.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
Now it's all about potty training. It's the time in your little one's life that you kind of look forward to, but also dread in equal measure, because having them potty trained means you're not spending a small fortune on nappies and no more fighting to get their nappy changed, and your baby bag kind of decreases significantly. But on the other hand, it's constantly asking them, do they need to go to the toilet, having that anxiety whenever you leave the house, and dealing, of course, with those little accidents too. So if you think that your child might be nearing the stage to say goodbye to nappies, or you're currently having a struggle with this stage in their life, you are in the right place. Principal Lisa, aka Potty Queen, is on the line with us right now with some great advice on when to start, some do's and don'ts too. And this mum called in with a question about her daughter.
She's currently 2 years and 10 months, and I had started potty training a couple of months ago because she herself decided that she was ready, and she was like, I don't want a nappy anymore and I want to do it in the potty. So I went along, even though I thought she was not ready, because she had just had the experience of arriving a new baby sister. So I went along with her. She was very good. She knows, like, when she needs to pee, she will run to the potty. The only thing was that whenever she wanted to poop, she would say, no, I need the nappy. And so we had to put the nappy on and she would poop in the nappy. And before all of this, she used to hate the aftermath of the poop. So she didn't like changing, washing and stuff. She would just avoid it as much as she can. So then we ran into periods of constipation where she had to be treated via suppositories and some laxatives because she would go so many days without doing it. And then she was like stuck in one place, can't push it and so on. So then I discussed it with her doctor and then he said that we could go back on the nappy training and just put the nappy back on. And maybe she's feeling the stress and she's holding her poop because her diet is actually okay and there's no issues there. So then I did that. I went backwards. But still, we're having some issues with constipation. So I don't know when to restart, really.
It's such a fraught time. And I think that message just sums it up, Lisa, in terms of trying to know when your child is ready and then ultimately trying to navigate this process. And here having to go to the doctor, it sounds really, really stressful and really confusing for everyone as well. How can you help that mum, Lisa?
Well, this is a mum I help every day. If you're not this particular mum, this is the type of mummy that I help every day. And in fact, actually, this is a typical example of a family that does need my help. This is quite a complex situation that needs to be balanced carefully. We've obviously got to work with the doctor here to checking in regularly on the constipation. What constipation medication are we having? Sometimes it can be helpful to have something like a Dulcilac in there that is just softening the stool to make it easier to pass. However, we also need to offer this little person a very consistent approach and to support the family. So with a family like this, I would work with them over the course of a month and they would have several consultations with me. They might have to go out and buy lots of little hacks and tricks and things that I use. And then I support them throughout on WhatsApp. And I would say 99% of the time I can help a family through this stage in about 4 weeks, but it can't be rushed. Mm-hmm. And I will often meet families further along the line, and I've recently worked with families with children ages six and seven with this problem. So I'm pleased to hear the little one's only two.
So this is by all means not a lost cause, far from it, but it does need, as you say, it's a complicated one and does need a bit of hand-holding, coaching and WhatsApping. Lisa, we've had a couple of messages saying how to get in touch with you. So for this mum and the other parents out there who do need perhaps one-on-one consultations in time, how can people reach you and ultimately sign up for your services?
I'm always pleased. I mean, I'd give you my telephone number. I really would. But you can get in touch with me on Instagram, principal_Lisa, or www.thepottyqueen.me. And I will answer as many families as I can. I just, that particular family, I don't want to jump in and give advice.
No. Because it does sound quite fraught.
It does need careful thought, and I always give families an evaluation of where they, I would go through eating, drinking, sleeping, behaviour, everything, so that we knew we were on the right track with what we're doing. And particularly with poop, poop challenges, is you want to get it right so that it goes on to be a positive relationship. But just one thing I would say, that anybody listening with that, is a lovely little book called Where's the Poop? Any books around poop, just to help diffuse poo,
Yeah, because I think that is the barrier. It's like the wee's we've sorted, it's the next bit that we're having the problem with. So, quite right. Where's the poop? There you go. Sales will soar. Inga saying, help, huge kid. Our son is 2 years, 9 months and he was a dream to potty train. No accidents after day two, dry through the night. But he doesn't like the toilet at all, just the potty. But he's very wide, so he doesn't really fit on it. He inevitably gets wee on the floor. Any idea for a potty that is bigger than usual? They all seem so small. I've got set for the toilet, but he hates them. Any ideas?
Okay, well, I would also be working on a reduction on potty dependence, because when he goes to school, he's going to need to go on the toilet. So start on a sort of an 80-20 rule. So 20% of the time you do actually practice using the toilet, making sure that you've got a really high step. We expect children to sit on the toilet, but with their legs dangling over the edges. In actual fact, it's a bit uncomfortable for them. So start using the toilet more and more, you know, go to 70-30 and vice versa. However, you could get an Easy Kids potty training seat. These are potties that I might use when I'm training older children. They're 48 centimetres high, so they're higher than a normal size potty. So you can use them with a bigger child. So that's Easy Kids, and you can get those at Mum's World.
I knew I was asking the right person. Message here saying, our daughter has suffered since 6 months old, age seven now. She's still on the daily dose of Movicol. Sending love to anyone facing issues. Yeah. Thank you so much for that. And no name on this one saying, our son is doing well, but when we go anywhere, he refuses to sit on a normal loo. Do I need a travel potty or a step to practice at home or both? Any advice, welcome.
Okay, two things. I would turn him into a toilet inspector. So whenever you get anywhere, we've talked about this as well before.
Can we have a uniform, a badge, a little hat, perhaps?
Yeah, exactly. We'd love it. So when you go anywhere, just say, you know, I'd really love it if you could just go and check out the toilet for me. You know, because I've heard, you know, they've got some quite nice toilet roll there. So go and see, you know, do they have toilet roll? What's their hand wash like? Give toilets a score. Even really small children, just play along with it and just... But the idea of this is to get them to connect with the toilet where you've gone to. Mm-hmm. So when you go to the mall, you say, oh, Dubai Mall is a five-star toilet, you know, or the other mall isn't. They'll have their own ideas of why it's five-star. So that's one thing I'll do, try to connect with the toilet. I do think a portable seat can really help. And I like the one, it's like something called, it's a squishy cushy or something. Again, I'm afraid it's another Mum's World purchase. But you can get them in these little drawstring bags. So you can just put it. Yeah, and they fold out seat. You've got the other potty, the My Carry potty, which is a travel potty that closes in on the peepees and the poopies. You can take it anywhere. The drawback to that one, it is quite small. Okay. So little bigger bottoms may not find it that comfortable.
Oh, Lisa, thank you so much for your help. We've also had a message saying poo book recommendation. We read it on the iPad. There you go. What a gap in the market. Who knew? Lisa, thank you so, so much. As you said, you can be found on Instagram at principal_Lisa, on hand for answering questions, consultations and booking coaching too. Really appreciate your insights this afternoon.
Oh,
so have a wonderful afternoon.
Family Matters.
On Afternoons with Helen Farmer.
We are covering the thorny issue now of weight around teens. This is all off the back of new research from UCL, that's University College London, that shows an increasing number of children are dieting to lose weight. 44% of 14-year-olds in 2015 said that they dieted, compared to only 30% of girls and boys in 2005. We don't have the figures for 2020, but I'm confident it will be even higher. Teenagers are also more likely to view exercise as a way to lose weight rather than the chance to have fun and socialise and feel healthy. Joined on the line now by eating psychology coach, it's Florence Guillet from Beyond Body Image. Florence, how are you?
I'm great. Nice to speak to you again. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. But as the mum of two daughters, this kind of research really concerns me. And we've spoken before about how difficult it can be as parents to not pass our own body issues onto our children. And it sounds like a simple thing to say, but, you know, comments like, oh, you know, this doesn't fit, or I shouldn't eat that, or, you know, there's so many little nuances in language and behaviours that can ultimately add up to be quite damaging for young children. And it's teens we're talking about here, where they're more in control of what they eat and how they exercise and how they control those behaviours and often hide those behaviours as well, which is a really scary thing, to be honest. And in your work with children, with young people at Beyond Body, have you heard from concerns from teenagers and their parents as well about dieting and disordered eating?
Yes, absolutely. And I think, unfortunately, you know, dieting, just like eating disorders, happens at very many different ages, right? So we know that in many countries, it starts really early on for some children. And it is definitely something we need to address, I think, as a society. Like, it, you know, we can control as parents what happens in our household, and there's a lot we can do already. But the reality is we are all a little bit the culture makers. Mm-hmm. And so we also have to be conscious of what is happening as a culture and maybe not engage as much in some of the dialogues that will be, for example, about, you know, oh, my body is not enough, or it's too much, or, oh, you know, look at this fat person, they're not taking care of themselves. All of these also actually participate in how teenagers kind of absorb those messages. And I think what's interesting with research that has been done by UCL is that it's put in perspective with Great Britain recently kind of saying they're going to do another big campaign against teenage obesity. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I think they forget that weight stigma is very, very present in all the different measures that they put in place, right? Giving more information about calories and then trying to lower sugar, you know, really doing anti-obesity advertising. The longer we keep demonizing people that live in a larger body, and I use it specifically, I don't like to use obesity because I don't think it's a disease, the longer we're going to have issues with teenagers actually dieting and hating their bodies and mental health issues and growing numbers of eating disorders. So we really have to get you know, to be aware, at least the first step would be.
We've even seen the likes of Weight Watchers releasing apps aimed at children with this traffic light system, thinking about some foods are green and good and red and bad. And it's a very tricky line to toe, because there's no denying it. The UA has an obesity problem when it comes to children. You know, the numbers are there. And, you know, I went to a theme park recently and was quite shocked, to be honest, at the number of very overweight children. And it really took me aback, because I think because of 2020, I actually haven't seen that many kids. You know, everyone's been at home. Yeah. And I was like, oh, my goodness, actually, this isn't just something we're here talking about on the news. You know, this is something that's in front of my eyes right now. But then, mm-hmm. How do we get that message of health across rather than weight?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's, you hit the nail on the head. I think as long as we keep saying weight and BMI has to be at the center of the health conversation, then we're missing the point. Because the reality is we've done all these anti-obesity campaigns where we put the calories on the meals, put them in the restaurant, where we tell people just eat less or eat less of the sugary things and all of that. But the reality is it's not just food. Health is not just food. Mm-hmm. Health is not just your weight. And we know, again, I think something that came up more and more in 2020 and that I'm delighted to see is that research is really showing that weight bias. So this discrimination we do constantly on people that have a higher BMI is actually causing more harm than good. Because when we tell, you know, young people or even adults, you need to diet, you need to watch what you eat, we know that it's not efficient, because 98% of diets actually don't work. And we oversimplify the fact that, you know, people will gain weight by, okay, they eat too much or they don't eat the right foods. But in the current situation, a lot of people are aware of what it means to eat properly.
I think we all do. You know, we have there's enough information out there. It's just looking at the reasons why we're making certain decisions. And I want to go to the text line now, actually, Florence, because a number of parents have got in touch about their teens. And Jenny's been on 4001 saying, my 14-year-old daughter has a really intense relationship with exercise. She'll eat a big dessert, then frantically work out to try and burn the calories. She is a bit overweight, according to the doctor, but then so am I. And I'm really worried that her relationship with food is already messed up at such a young age. So any advice then to Jenny? Because her daughter obviously is aware of calories in and calories out. And if she says she's overweight, what she needs to kind of so-called do to be healthy. But how can we have conversations with our teens without creating more problems?
Mm-hmm. I think it's important that we debunk some of the methods we've used in the past to kind of manage health. Because we start seeing more and more than the whole conversation we have about calories, about BMIs, about staying in this normal zone of the BMI is actually not really encouraging people to have healthy practices, right? It just puts them on this focus of, if I lose weight, everything is going to be fine. But by all means, like if you lose weight and you actually self-harm, then mm-hmm. you're not going to get healthier. Mm-hmm. So I think some of the things that definitely I would say, if a parent is concerned about their child, they should seek help. Because it's going to be very, very difficult for them to even identify and be aware of what they should do, what they should say. So I think get help, like reach out to practitioners. There are plenty of people who work with disordered eating and eating disorders. And as you know, I'm also an active volunteer for the Middle East Eating Disorder Association. So this is a great way to get free advice on who to reach out to, and then get like a, you know, get the consultation to understand really what the issue is, how to address it. Is it something that really will require a lot of effort? If it's still in the first steps, you know, and it's still something that hasn't been going on for a really long time, there's a good chance that you can address this in a positive way. But parents usually need help in that, and the teenager person as well. So I would say, get help. And then as a parent, we know, right, it's always the same. It's fixing our own body image issues or weight issues, in the sense of, if we don't accept the way we look, if we're constantly on a diet, if we're constantly saying, I should be different, mm-hmm. I haven't exercised enough today, I ate this, but oh my God, I'm blaming myself, I feel so guilty, I shouldn't have, or I weigh myself constantly. Basically, our children are going to learn from the models that they have in front of them.
Florence, earlier we had a message from Nazreen saying, I've always had a really sensible attitude towards food, I don't overeat, I'm really careful not to talk about dieting in front of my children, but it hasn't stopped my teenage girls constantly describing themselves as fat. How can I stop them? It's so tricky. What do you think?
So I want to say first that we are living through really difficult circumstances mm-hmm. this year, right? And I think if anyone is really affected by the isolation, it's teenage girls and boys. So I would say that sometimes if you hear your teen kind of saying, I feel fat, I feel disgusting, you know, sometimes we get into immediately being scared. And that's totally understandable, because we're like, no, you're beautiful, everything's fine. Or we could actually encourage them to say, why don't we watch a little bit what we eat, you know, so you can feel better. But I would say, I want to remind those parents, absolutely no dieting for children and teenagers. They are still growing. They should not be avoiding foods or counting foods or reducing the amounts of foods they eat. But I would say also, listen to what they have to say. If they feel fat, usually it's another feeling that's hiding behind. It's feeling like they don't belong. It's maybe something happening at school. It's them looking at social media, as you said, and seeing constantly images that don't look like them. Mm-hmm. It's maybe teaching them a bit about media literacy as well. So really kind of try to stay as quiet as you can and just listen. And based on that, you'll be able to be much more ready for whatever is actually hiding behind those feelings.
Florence, is it perhaps too simple to say that social media sites, you know, your Instagrams, are making young people more worried about weight? You know, I remember that grunge phase when I was growing up, Kate Moss so tiny, and everyone saying then that she was a bad influence on teenagers. So hasn't this been a problem for decades?
Totally. And the problem is, we all know rationally that most of the images that we see are retouched and photoshopped and airbrushed, but we still compare to those.
I do. I'm 38, never mind 14. You know, we know this, but there's something in our brain that doesn't necessarily allow us to fully understand it.
Absolutely. But what you can do with your teen is really start having discussions with them, is really look at what they're looking on social media, what you're watching on TV, and starting having discussions. Is this realistic? Did you notice that all of the people in the series look the same? Have you noticed that there might not be the same representation of body sizes or of, you know, ethnic backgrounds or gender identities? This is something you can discuss with your team. And I think we have to, because if they make a social media feed that is more representative of different types of bodies, mm-hmm. we know that that also is going to influence their brain to see beauty in different shapes and sizes.
And this starts early as well about, you know, we're going to be talking about Barbie later on and the, you know, the a study that Barbie commissioned around play. But, you know, there are dolls of all colours and thankfully, my goodness, it wasn't the case for me in the 80s, body shapes as well. So to be giving our children these from a really early age, they're not just looking at the same colour skin and the same body shape. You know, and also it comes back to books. I mean, there are things we can be doing, certainly away from social media at a much early age. Unfortunately, that's all we've got time for, Florence. But if anyone wants to speak to you directly, and as I say, get any coaching or use you as a resource for Middle East Eating Disorder Association as well, what's the best way of getting in touch?
So my website is beyondbodyimage.com. And then MEDA, so the Middle East Eating Disorder Association, is MEEDA.ME.
Thank you so, so much. I know this is a conversation that's going to continue as it should. And we'll speak to you very, very soon. Thank you to for getting
Thanks
in touch.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And thank you to everyone who reached out on the show. If we couldn't get to your message, I will be sure to reply with Florence's details.
This is Afternoons with Helen Farmer on Dubai Eye 103.8.
Thanks for tuning in to the Afternoons with Helen Farmer podcast. Don't forget, we are live on Dubai Eye 103.8, Sunday to Thursday between 2 and 5.
You've been listening to a Dubai Eye 103.8 podcast. To enjoy lots more from Dubai Eye in the United Arab Emirates, just go to dubaieye1038.com or find them wherever you normally get your podcasts.